Welcome to the Fitness to Dive podcast. I am Dr. David Charish. I am a dive medicine physician, board certified in emergency medicine and undersea and hyperbaric medicine. A question every diver should ask themselves prior to any dive is, am I fit to dive? As a hyperbaric physician and diving consultant, I work with the diving community to evaluate and treat diving-related issues. As an educator, I offer lectures, workshops, seminars, and symposium on all aspects of dive safety, dive technology, and dive medicine. A question every diver should ask themselves prior to any dive is, am I fit to dive? Understanding what constitutes fitness to dive is key to our ability to process this information and allow for effective decision making. In a real-world example, as a diver, with a dive trip scheduled and now with a new medical diagnosis and recently prescribed medication, what information do you need to both absorb this information about your medical condition and have the cognitive ability to make an informed decision? We will have conversations with leaders in the fields of dive safety, dive technology, dive medicine, and most importantly, divers. These podcasts will explore the many aspects of fitness to dive. We can better understand our fitness to dive as we address these six areas: medical fitness, psychological fitness, nutrition, physical fitness, knowledge, and physical skill. So whether you are a recreational diver, technical diver, public safety diver, scientific diver, commercial diver, military diver, or free diver, understanding your fitness to dive will make your diving safer and more enjoyable. There is an intersection between dive medicine, dive safety, and dive technology. Understanding those relationships allows each of us to enjoy diving in a safe manner. The early pioneers of diving and hyperbaric medicine created the foundation for our understanding of this intersection. There is much that has been learned over the many years, and one could say there is also much that is not known. Today's podcast features a conversation with dive researcher Frauke Tillmans. Dr. Tillmans is the research director of Divers Alert Network. She has a degree in human biology and a PhD specializing in oxidative stress, which is involved in acute diving injuries and may affect long-term health of divers. Throughout her career, she has participated in global collaborative projects covering decompression stress, inert gas narcosis, and oxygen toxicity. Before coming to Divers Alert Network in 2019, Frauke conducted her research in the experimental medicine section of the German Naval Medical Institute. In addition to her research experience, Frauke is also an experienced public safety diver, scientific diver, and technical diver. Tillmans' commitment to safety is apparent in almost every aspect of her activities that she pursues. And when she is not diving or supervising researchers, Frauke is an active volunteer firefighter who enjoys endurance and self-defense training. Thank you for joining the conversation on fitness and diving.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Great. So I have a question. Your accomplishments as a diver are exceptional. So technical diver, public safety diver, dive instructor with multiple dive training agencies, how has this experience allowed you to develop as a researcher in dive physiology, human biology?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have been a scientific diver from the beginning. So in 2007, I was certified as a scientific diver. And I always found that the theory behind it, or the theory courses that we took, more interesting than anything else. So we did a lot of physiology, decompression theory, and so on. And I just had a ton of questions, and I didn't know why those questions weren't answered. So I thought, we talk about bubbles, but that is not, I don't understand this. This doesn't make any sense. So I started digging deeper into it, and I just developed even more questions. And I've this has been the case throughout all my diving career. I've done more training and more training and more training, and all it did was open up more questions and more questions and more questions. And that is something that is the source of being a researcher, is asking more questions. And going through all that training really gave me the opportunity to connect with those communities that are under-researched. So the technical diving community has a lot of questions that are just not answered yet. And I feel better connected and have a better grasp on that since I have gone through all that training and am a scientific and a public safety and a technical diver now.
Understood. So pursuing a PhD is a significant commitment. What is your motivating factor for pursuing this pathway?
Yeah, doing a PhD is indeed a big commitment. My PhD took 6 years to complete, and it was a conscious decision to get into it. By the time, I studied biology, and in my biology studies, at some point you get frustrated. I think everyone who's been in college has gotten frustrated with their degree at some point. And I ventured into EMS and teaching diving for a while. And then at some point I figured, this might not be enough. I studied this for a reason. So I went back into it. And what you realize once you get back into academia and you want to stay in the scientific field, you can't go around a PhD. It's really the logical next step, the succession plan. You need to have a PhD because it shows your peers that you can actually do things and that you can go through a full project planning and completion and get that to fruition in the end. And the other thing it does is it keeps you on your toes. That is definitely something I can say. And once you have a PhD, it makes you eligible to apply for a lot of funding. So in dive research, you need to get the money to do the research or in any type of research. And the only way to do that is to apply for public funds or for national funds that you just can't do if you don't have a PhD. So I made that commitment and pulled through.
Well, thank you for doing that. Better you than me, I would say. So you work as a researcher with the experimental medicine section of the German Naval Medical Institute. Sounds very interesting. What were some of the projects that you were involved with?
So the Naval Medical Institute employs a lot of military people, but I was recruited as a civilian. And everything they do is about the safety and the advancement in warfare. So it is all tailored to the military diving. And in our case, that was mostly the special forces units, so combat swimmers, for example. And the main project I was working on back there was a project with combat swimmers. And we compared those to athletes as well as couch potatoes in their performance, so their exercise capacity. And we did see that that being a combat swimmer in training or being an athlete has significant value for your immune system and your resistance. And even more so when you're a combat swimmer, because you don't only are at the peak of your physical shape, you also have this additional oxidative stress going on. And that can be negative, but it also can be positive. So we found a lot of immune function was a lot better in that population than it was in the amateur athletes or the couch potatoes that were our control group.
Okay, so I'm getting off the couch today.
Very good.
All right. So are there any global collaborative research projects that you've been involved with?
So in 2014, I was recruited to be part of the FIPOD project, and that is a one-of-a-kind project that since we're trying to get something off the ground that is similar to that, but it's really challenging. So what FIPOD was, it stands for Physiopathology of Decompression, and it was a European-funded project. The European Union put a lot of money into this. And it was initially a training network. So they recruited 14 young upcoming researchers in the field or not yet in the field that were working on all kinds of diving safety and diving physiology projects, be that decompression stress, be that nitrogen narcosis, be that oxygen toxicity. So all those projects were ongoing under this one umbrella project. And it was a collaboration of, I want to say, 12 countries in Europe. So we did a lot of travel. We collaborated. It was international and multidisciplinary. And as I said, it was one of a kind and was really a good experience. And some of those researchers still in the field. So Dr. Buzzacott, for example, was in the field before but has stayed on since and is still collaborating with us. Dr. Papadopoulou from UNC was in that project, and we still have good collaborations between us.
Excellent. Are there any multinational studies currently?
So I wish I could say yes, and the plan is really to get there and to have more multinational studies again. However, COVID has really hit us hard, so where we're trying to be more collaborative, the actual travel is very restricted still. And so the aim is to get there again, but there's no big collaborations going on right this moment.
Understood. In 2019, you assumed the role of Director of Research for Divers Alert Network. What is a typical day in that position?
So my typical day is a lot of administration. And that sounds exactly as unsexy as it is. I go to the office and I do a lot of administrative work, as in trying to find more funding for the projects we're doing, trying to organize and administer the projects that are ongoing, trying to keep the team on track, on progress on the projects. So I have different areas that I'm working in. I inherited the injury monitoring project. So we monitor fatalities, diving fatalities and near misses, and I do have help with that. We do physiological research. That is my main bread and butter. So we employ projects where we monitor divers pre, post, and ideally during the dive on various physiological parameters. And what the research department at DAN also has since a few years is the DAN Research Grant Program. So we don't only try to get funding from public sources for the research we do, we also give out money for research for the people that are already doing really good work. So we have this grant program established for the diving community to help other institutions to do this work and to advance knowledge in dive safety. And then the last thing we do is every summer, and this is really exciting, the DAN Research Internship Program. And that is something that is really trying to do what we did in FIPOD before. And it has a long history. It's been done at DAN for 20 years, and we have young minds, young students coming in, spending the summer with us and learning all about research.
Tell me more about that DAN Research Intern Program. What is the process to select or join or apply for the program?
The Research Internship Program is, I said, a summer program. We select anywhere between 2 and 5 students per year in the different departments. I usually get 1 to 3 interns that work with me, and they would be involved in all parts of the research project. So whatever projects are ongoing, I will make smaller projects out of there or cut pieces out of that project, and they will be responsible for finishing that within the 12 to 14 weeks that they will be with us in the summer. It's situated in North Carolina, in Durham, so you need to come to headquarters if you want to be an intern at DAN. And we select that depending on the skill and the application that the intern is sending in, but then also the needs that we have. Obviously, it is an internship program an education program for that young intern that is coming in, but we need to get something out of it. So whatever project we work with or we have them work on needs to somehow be good for them. So if I say you're now involved in the bubble study, but your background is in nutrition, so we're going to have you focus on just the nutrition part of that study that we're doing at the time. And then we hope that they get something out of it. And the gold standard goal is to have them participate in some kind of scientific meeting later and actually present the findings that they got during that internship.
And hopefully set a foundation of interest for lifelong research in the field of diving medicine, dive physiology, or dive safety, I'm assuming.
Precisely.
Yeah. Well, that sounds great. How do you prepare the DAN research interns at the beginning of each year?
So once they're selected, which is usually in February, we get in touch with them. We tell them, you'll be here by May. And then usually mid, end of May or beginning of June, we have a week-long course that will prepare them for field research, which includes all kinds of training that we do on how to use all the equipment we have, how to take anthropometric data, how to analyze urine samples, how to handle blood samples or other samples that we collect from divers, how to communicate with divers in the field, how to recruit them, what are some ethical concerns that we have that you need to mitigate, what to do and what not to do when you wear a dance shirt because all of a sudden you are representing a global diving safety organization. So all of that is part of that first week. And then during the course of that internship, we usually give them more training on other skills that a researcher might need. So presentation skills and time management and how to talk to lay audiences. So there's nothing worse than the research coming out, but you can't translate it to the people that actually want to know what we have been researching because that's who we do it for.
Sure. And then who are the faculty that teach the internship research training?
So obviously, most of the faculty comes from in-house. We have Dan internal. They come from all departments, from communications, from medicine. But then we also take people, we take advantage of the location where we are because we're a stone throw away from Duke University. So we work together with the staff from the Hyperbaric Chamber to teach some of the course. And then the other direction, same stone throw, is UNC, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And we have staff from there teaching mainly on ultrasound acquisition. So all this is, it's a very high scale course because we do have all those resources in right there in the area that we can count on.
Wow. And do the research interns need to be a diver?
They certainly don't have to, but it helps. So as I said in the beginning, when you know how it is to be immersed and you know what challenges some divers face, you have a different understanding and with that a different connection to the divers. And because a lot of the research that we do is actually interacting with divers, it makes a lot of sense if you have at least gotten an open water certification and want to go further. And what we do offer, diving is not officially part of the internship, but we do offer some training to advance knowledge for the interns. And there's plenty of opportunity. Once we're at the quarry and we're diving with our subjects, then there's usually an opportunity to jump in the water too.
Wow. So at many levels, great opportunity for an interested intern for sure. And with your mentorship and the mentorship of your team, I think they will have a great experience.
I think so too.
What research are you currently involved in as Director of Research at Divers Alert Network?
I guess the flagship study that we're still doing and that we started in 2020 when this you-know-what hit us like a sledgehammer is the COVID study. So we call that DRACO, the Diver Return to Diving After COVID Infection. And this is a survey-based study where COVID survivors could sign up voluntarily to answer a few questions for us. So how bad was your infection? How long did it take you to recover? When did you return to diving? How did you cope with all the side effects? And then we also want to know, once you returned to diving, was this a good dive? Was it a bad dive? Did you have any symptoms during that dive? So from that questionnaire, we keep following up, and initially over 1,600 people signed up for this study, and a few of them we had to exclude, but the first data set that came out of it is 1,300 people that were infected with COVID and were planning to return to diving or had returned to diving. And that is, if you look at diving research in general, this is a huge number. You usually find studies that have an N equals or participation of 20, or if it's a really big study, 40 people, and getting 1,300 people into a study is fantastic. And we're now at the 2-year mark where we follow up with them again, how they have been, If they are still diving, if they have any persisting symptoms of that infection, if they got reinfected, if they got their vaccines. So all this is something very important to figure out. And we again had dropouts, obviously, but we're still at about 500 of those. And that is great. And then the other really big study we're doing right now is called VGE variability. And that is a mouthful of that, that people usually don't know what that is. So I'm going to break that down. VGE is venous gas emboli, or what people generally say, refer to as bubbles. So the microbubbles that can cause decompression sickness. And we do know that every diver in the world will have bubbles at some point if you just expose them to pressure long enough and deep enough. So what we don't know is why some people bubble more and some people bubble less. So what this study is about is we sent people in the quarry in North Carolina six times every Saturday for 6 weeks in a row. They cannot dive in between or not during the week. And then what we try to find out is what changes are there. So if they bubble more on the second Saturday or the third Saturday, what has changed within the week? So we're also asking a lot of questions. What was your exercise? What have you eaten the last 24 hours? Then we collect samples to do hydration measurements. So we collect pee samples. We draw blood on some days and send them off to Maryland to Dr. Thom, who is analyzing them for microparticles, so for an immune response. We look at anthropometrics, which is just a fancy way to say that we have divers in all shapes and sizes, really. And all that together is hopefully going to answer some of the questions and why some people bubble less and some people bubble more. And some days, people that haven't bubbled in 5 weeks all of a sudden develop those bubbles after the same exact dive. And that is hopefully going to be really, really exciting once we get to analyze all that data.
And it seems like if we can come to a gripping conclusion with better understanding, we improve dive safety. I mean, that's sort of the end result here, I'm hoping.
Oh, right. Absolutely. We're looking for something that we can give divers to say, look, here's what you should be doing, or this is what you probably should avoid before the dive, so you lower your risk of decompression sickness.
Absolutely. So what is the composition of the research team at Divers Alert Network?
So my team currently is comprised of three full-time employees, very soon four, and plus myself, and a handful of contractors. So everyone is working in their own specialized field. I have Kat Harris working on injury monitoring, so she's the one screening the internet and following up on fatal incidents and near misses in diving. She's also the one that gets all the diving incident reports in the voluntary reporting system we have. And then I have two research associates that are mainly on the physiological part, Grant and Rhiannon, doing a really good job on employing all those studies in the field. So the cardiac study that we're also doing with the public safety diving community right now, I have Grant traveling to all those sites to training events where we collect EKGs and we collect ultrasound measurements of them. And then everyone in my team is involved in the VGE variability study, so the bubble, the big new bubble study. And someone I've just recruited recently is Dr. Dugrineau. He's going to join us from France, hopefully in November. That is going to be very exciting because he has a background in genetics, something we haven't had on the team before. And we are growing. And then I have a handful of contractors that I recruit depending on what a project needs. So if we don't have the expertise in-house, then we get someone in who has. Or we're still working with a lot of the interns that we had as contractors over the years because they wanted to stay involved. And so we give them the opportunity to work 5-10 hours a week on the project that they've done. But now we actually pay them for it. So,
well, great opportunities. Let's talk about partnerships and research. I think partnerships are really key to getting through projects successfully. What organizations do you collaborate with?
So that is a fantastic point you're making there, because obviously we don't have all the expertise in-house. Dan can only employ so many people. So it is of vital importance that on everything where we don't have the expertise, we get the experts in from other organizations. And one of our main collaborators is the University of North Carolina, that started with a grant that we gave them 5 years ago. And it has developed into a big collaboration with Dr. Papadopoulou and her team in the ultrasound lab over there. We work with Duke University and the Hyperbaric Chamber. We work with the University of California in San Diego on mainly the diving, the free diving research, because we don't have free diving projects in-house again. So we're working with them on that. We also support fellowships. So the if we have hyperbaric physicians in training, a lot of organizations or universities are doing a really good job in training those, and we fund those fellowships for them. So all those collaborations, including collaborations with gear manufacturers that we have that reach out to us, and they're usually asking for endorsement. We can't endorse one or another manufacturer over another manufacturer, but we usually they're usually open to collaborations. We also have some industry partners that are mainly funded through the Office of Naval Research on projects that we're collaborating on, and are doing some field testing for them on prototypes that are just not on the market yet. So yeah, it's a vital part of research to have this network and this this grid of people that are experts in the field. So we just can't provide all knowledge and all expertise. We rely on a big network, and that is something very unique to the diving world, because the network is very strong. And when you get a chance to get to the conferences that we hold every year, the one in Europe for the EUBS, or the one here in the US for the UHMS, it feels more like a family network, not so much as a scientific conference, and that is just something very unique in this field.
Right, and I see that the importance of that collaboration is the success of the research that you're doing, and that only imparts safety to the diving community.
That is correct. Everything Dan does is tailored towards the diving safety, the safety of the diving community.
So let's talk about what the process is to get volunteers to participate in your research.
So our research currently, and this goes back to the challenge that we are in the end points of this, or so, still somewhere in the middle of that pandemic, is that worldwide travel is somewhat restricted. And so most of the research we do right now is in North Carolina, in the quarries around North Carolina, and not a lot of people like diving quarries in the middle of North Carolina. But if you want to become a researcher, a research subject, you go to the website, you can sign up there. It's under research and reports, and you find the place where it says get involved, and you sign up, and we will contact you. We also host frequent info sessions, especially for the bubble study. So if people are interested and just don't know if this is right for them, they attend one of our info sessions. They're usually Tuesdays. And one of my associates or myself are going to explain what the study is about, how to do that. And then if you're still up for it, you can sign up and just shoot us an email. research@dan.org will usually get answered within 3 to 4 days. And we sign you up, and then we tell you where to be, and then you're a research subject.
Excellent. So what are some of the challenges of being a dive physiology researcher, with the exception of trying to get research volunteers? What are some of the other challenges?
Well, in general, being in diving physiology is, one is the funding, because diving physiology is a very small field, and being a DAN has a lot of advantages, because we have some funding for research and we can do things in-house. but some projects just need a lot more money. If we think genetic testing, or if we think big scale, big projects with a lot of dives, or we need to get into a hyperbaric chamber to test something, that just costs a lot of money. So getting that funding is one challenge. Prices of helium haven't helped in the technical diving research we do, but that is a minor challenge. But in general, I think the biggest challenge for diving research is to recruit and retain young people, which is why our internship program is so important. We have a few young researchers that have stayed in the field. We usually have a retention rate of about 25% of those that complete our internship program, which is great. But having people that are motivated to stay in this field, which is likely not going to pay very well, is probably the biggest challenge that we face right now.
As in most areas of research, I would say.
Most areas, yes.
So how does the mission of Divers Alert Network and the direction and findings of the ongoing research benefit our diving community?
So obviously, all the research we do needs to have some kind of endpoint. So once we finish a project, I already said most of the time this opens more questions than it answers. But once we have those questions answered, we publish it in peer-reviewed scientific journals, mainly because that is what researchers do. But then the next step is, once it's published there and it's been peer-reviewed, so other people have agreed that this was a worthwhile effort, then we need to translate it to the diving community. And this is one of the big things that Dan does is, once we finish a project, we start making material to actually answer the questions that the diving community had. And a lot of the projects actually came from conversations with the diving community. So I was on a boat with a lot of spearfishers, and they said, well, yeah, we're doing these bounce dives all the time, and it's especially the ones that go to the tournaments and spearfish to be the one who gets the biggest fish or the most fish or whatever it is. But then you think, is it safe? Is it safe dive practice? So one of the projects we did was follow them and looked at cognitive performance in those divers and looked at what kind of physiological strain is on them while they participate in those tournaments. And we're coming really close to an end of that study, so I'm hoping that we will be able to get that information out there and see how safe those type of tournaments really are. Another one was that we did a study on caustic cocktails for rebreather divers that is an actual danger that could happen, that you experience a caustic cocktail, which is a solution that we get when water and scrubber material mix. And it can burn your throat and can burn your mouth once you ingest it or you get it in your mouth. And the idea is that you need to flush that out with water right away. So you need to bail out of your loop, and then you need to flush it, and then you usually don't get back on the loop and need to end that dive. So a lot of knowledge about those caustic cocktails comes from instructors, and a lot of that comes from manufacturers. But what we also know is that there's a lot of talk in the diving community, and if someone says, well, you need to rinse with vinegar, or you need to wait until you have something more acidy to flush with, then people will hold off on this common sense first aid response, isn't just flushing with water, and wait until they get to their truck to get a Coke. And this is not what we want. So the next step is to go in and say, okay, here's what you need to do. This is the recommended first aid. Yes, it's not discouraged to drink Coke after that caustic cocktail, but the first thing needs to be that you flush with water.
Absolutely.
This is something that needs just reinforcing in the diving community. And I see Dan as the entity that needs to do that.
Right, and that's in their mission statement, right? Dive safety and education.
Absolutely. Everything Dan does is making diving safer, one dive at a time. And we do that with education programs. We do that with our research. We do that with our medical hotline. So everything we do revolves about diving safety.
Dr. Frauke Tillmans, thank you for taking the time to speak with us on this very important topic.
Thank you for having me again.
This is Dr. David Charish, dive medicine physician with Dive Medicine Hyperbaric Consultants, thanking our podcast audience for listening to another episode of Fitness and Diving. Stay tuned for more episodes and continued conversation on fitness and diving.